Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm getting ready for the bomb cyclone. It's supposed to be like negative 35 wind chill in Minnesota on Thursday.
Oh my God. What does that even feel like?
It's, well, if you're feeling it, then you're doing something wrong. Like, you're not supposed to. You're supposed to stay inside. But it's supposed to be like minus 70 wind chill in Sioux Falls.
I can't even conceptualize that.
That'll kill you.
When I lived in Ann Arbor, the only time they ever canceled class for weather-related reasons was not because it was snowing, but because it got too cold and no one believed that the undergraduates would dress appropriately to go to class.
You got to look cute. Doesn't matter how cold it is. You've got to look cute.
Have you ever gone clubbing in Connecticut in January?
No, and I lived in Connecticut.
Which can say.
Why have you gone clubbing in Connecticut? Oh, because you went. Oh, because you went to that. You went to the seditious conspiracy law school.
I've spent some time in the state of Connecticut, and I will say I lived off of Crown Street, which was like
or Middletown.
I lived like on the street that had all these clubs and bars, and you would go and people would be like, you don't want to wear a jacket because you don't have to check your jacket and lose it. So people would just be like in out gear in January.
These people were not aware of the concept of the frat jacket or the fracket, which is the jacket you wear to the frat party. And then if you lose it, it doesn't matter. Let's be clear. I did not do this as an undergraduate, but I did spend 6 years at a Big Ten school. So I learned about the existence of these things.
So it's like a burner jacket.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It's like a burner jacket.
It doesn't have to be cute. Like it is understood that it like shapeless sleeping bag.
It's got to keep you warm enough as you're waiting in line to get into the frat party. And then if someone else takes it or you lose it, NBD, I mean, you're going to be cold on your way home.
Right. That won't you freeze to death on the way back?
But you'll be super drunk by then, so it'll be fine.
Or you just take someone else's jacket. Like, that's the other, the other like option.
Communal.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Rational Security. I am one of your co-hosts, Scott R. Anderson. I'm thrilled to be here once again with my two regular co-hosts, Quinta Jurassic.
Hello.
And Alan Rosenstein.
Hello, hello.
And to be joined by our fellow Lawfare senior editor and fellow Brookings fellow, Molly Reynolds. Molly, thank you so much for being here once again on Rational Security. No doubt to dip deep into the other branch, the other political branch that we don't talk about as much as we should, but we still talk about a fair amount, Congress.
What the hell was that about?
That wasn't my cleanest intro, I'm not going to lie.
We talk about Congress a lot.
Also, Molly's so much more than just a Congress nerd. She's here for her entertaining personality, frankly.
The other branch.
Yeah, what does that
branch
even mean, Scott?
The other, I said the other political branch. We talk about the judiciary a fair amount.
Also, the judiciary is a political branch, let's be clear.
Well, they don't think of themselves as one. That's not according fire to them, they're not.
Molly coming in hot.
Back on track, everyone.
There we go.
Tighten up.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here, Molly, especially right as we are getting ready and easing into the holidays. This will be our last regular episode of 2022, although we will be having a very special episode for you next week of listener-submitted object lessons and topics. But until then, we are happy to have Molly here with us for what we are calling the Fracket Fracas edition, because this has been, in a week that has nothing to do with frackets or fracases, really, a big week, of course, in national security news. As we wind up to the end of the year, it's a moment to look behind the year behind us, what's happened, look a little bit to the year ahead about what is yet to come, and do a little bit of speculation. And we have a lot of things falling into place as we get to the end of the year and people are trying to squeeze in last bits of national security work before the holidays. And that's given us a lot to talk about. So our first topic for this week, topic one, don't fear the referrals. It's a cowbell.
No, very, very nicely.
Oh,
God.
My God.
More cowbell. I'm frustrated. Oh, that's another cowbell. It just went off. That was an errant cowbell. Apologies.
Please get your cowbells in order, Scott.
I was very frustrated because I was all set to finally use a listener-submitted topic name, which was Referral Madness, which somebody pointed out we should have done the last time we talked about referrals. And another podcast stole it out from under us, not yesterday. So I couldn't use it. So I had to improvise for another one. So don't fear the referrals. It's as good as we're going to get. As its presumed end draws nigh with the new Congress, the January 6th committee is racing to bring its work to a close. Yesterday, it voted to make four sets of criminal referrals, including for former President Trump. It also released a 100-page draft executive summary for its forthcoming report, which we are still waiting on as of the time of recording. What more should we expect from the committee, and what impact will these steps have? Topic two, the grapes of Vlad. Like grapes of wrath. This is a hard one. We've done a lot of Ukraine topics. I'm kind of out of topics at this point. The U.S. Congress sent a strong message of support to Ukraine this week by committing $45 billion in U.S. assistance over the coming year, which is a little more than a year, even more than requested initially by the Biden administration. But there are few signs that Russia's poor performance thus far is threatening Russian President Vladimir Putin's control of the country. Instead, he seems to be settling in for a long-haul strategy of waiting out Western and Ukrainian resistance. What trajectory is this conflict headed in as it approaches the one-year mark? Where do we think it is likely to go? And topic three, showdown at the OK Corral. The Republican Party is set to take control of the House in January, but who will be leading it remains up in the air as Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy is still struggling to secure enough support from the far right wing of his party. His supporters are circling the wagon, most recently by publicly wearing OK pins, signaling their support for only Kevin. But can he get across the threshold? I had to fight to not laugh at this one, Alan. You could do me the same dignity.
It's so lame. It's so lame.
It is not great. It's not a cool, super cool move, guys. Sorry, House Republicans, but that's okay. But can Kevin get across the threshold? And at what cost? I will admit my alternate title for this topic was just Kevin, like Home Alone, but I decided that was too much. I'm not sure people would get it.
The title should have been, we have to talk about Kevin.
Yes, Quentin and I have been making this joke for the better part of a week.
I thought we had already used, I was pretty sure we already used that one, I thought.
Have we?
Maybe not. I thought we had. It occurred to me. Well, regardless, Alan, you are up for our first topic. So why don't you get us started? You can call it whatever you would like.
So
and I have the cowbell ready anytime.
Just the delight on your face when you made that cowbell bell. Okay, so let's talk about the January 6th committee. So we are recording this on Tuesday afternoon. So yesterday, Monday, the January 6th committee met for the last time. It turns, it dissolves. It turns into a pumpkin at the end of this Congress. And so it has, some work to finish up. Yesterday, or Monday rather, the committee released the 160-170-page introduction to what is expected to be a kind of an 800-page report. We think that's going to be released on Wednesday when you're all listening to this, along with the transcripts and other evidence, though that may be delayed a few days. They're clearly kind of working to the wire on this one. In addition to the report, the committee held a business meeting, not a hearing. Molly, I would like a gold star for getting that distinction right.
This is like my greatest life achievement, is teaching all of you the correct terminology for when members of a congressional committee gather for different purposes.
Do they ever have a non-business meeting? Do they ever have like a just for kicks meeting that they need the business descriptor? Not really, right? It's just one type of meeting.
I suppose that you would call a gathering of members of the committee that is non-public a meeting. But in terms of things that have like formal titles, you have hearing and you have business meetings.
I think the actually generic measure word for a gathering of Congress people is an ego trip. But yes, and hearings and that are all sub.
That now sub that's examples. A bad joke. Well
thank
played.
You. Thank you. Thank you. The real question is, when do they wear frackets? So at this business meeting, they kind of gave a greatest hits overview of what they've been investigating for the last year and a half. Nothing too new. And then they ended with criminal referrals with Trump and some of his associates. For Trump in particular, on four charges, fraud, obstruction of Congress, conspiracy to make a false statement, and most notably, insurrection. And they did some other things as well. So Quinta, let me start with you. So did we learn anything new on Monday, either with respect to what the committee said or what the committee put in the document it released, or what we think the full document may reveal when it comes out?
Not really. It seems like much more of a kind of capstone of what the committee has already done than providing actual new information. I think the sort of one little nugget was that they appear to have successfully interviewed Trump's aide, Hope Hicks. There was video of her at the business meeting. There are quotes from her included in the executive summary. And I should say we talked about this in a Lawfare event that, dear listener, will be available to you as a podcast on Wednesday, the day that you're listening to this. But overall, it's kind of a, you know, rehash greatest hits. There are some interesting stuff in there, as Ben Wittes has noted in a Lawfare piece, in the end notes that suggest that there may be sort of some interesting details to mine when the full report comes out. But overall, I don't think this is much of a surprise for anyone who's been paying attention to what the committee has been doing so far.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. Quinta mentioned that we saw a video of an interview the committee did with Hope Hicks that we had not previously seen. That interview came, I believe, after the last business meeting that the committee had in October. We know from the end notes that there are some other and from some public reporting that there are some other interviews they did after their last business meeting, including another interview with Tony Ornato, who worked at the White House on January 6th, who is someone who they actually call out in this introductory material, as the committee has some questions about the veracity of his statements to them. But in that, I think beyond that, most of what we learned yesterday that was new was just about, like, well, what is the approach that the committee has chosen to take to releasing to the public the product of its work. And so that began yesterday with this document labeled Introductory Material to the Final Report. We can talk about sort of the substance of that in a minute. Quinta has some thoughts. I know we did not in the podcast, the Lawfare podcast that we did on this topic. One thing we didn't get to involves referrals of four sitting members of Congress to the House Ethics Committee. We can talk about that. But I think just as Alan said, as we sort of look ahead towards what else we're expecting, it is a more voluminous report itself and then some amount of additional material. There are in this document that was released on Monday, there are 70 named individuals who are interviewed. So there are they're cited in the footnotes. They're cited to 35 separate document productions. So that's a subset of what we know they did. We don't know whether for sure every one of the cited interviews will be released. We don't know how many more will be released. There's a lot of uncertainty as we're recording this, but that's basically, I think, where we left things with the business meeting yesterday.
You know, I'll say, you all did a really excellent episode that Molly's already alluded to, the Lawfare podcast this morning. I think we'll be in the Lawfare pod this feed the same day that this episode of Rational Security drops. So folks should definitely check that out. But I did not participate. So I'm going to share my random thoughts on a few things that I did not get to throw in there. But I'll throw it out for your reaction, because I think it's a little different than some folks. And for my sins, I think I am in the Ben Wittes camp in many regards in terms of my reaction to what happened yesterday, in that it's not clear to me that this is going to be the thing that is kind of like the capstone of their work. Like, it is because it's the written product, right? But I think a lot of the impact of the committee's work has kind of already been felt through the hearings that have already really begun this long conversation about, you know, what Donald Trump has done, what he would mean for the future of the Republican Party, that, as we talked about in this podcast, other places, at least I personally think you're already seeing ramifications of in various regards in the midterm elections and in kind of the actions around the Republican Party as people are beginning to reframe it and kind of look past Trump as potential leadership figure, although, you know, still very uncertain exactly where that's going to lead. The more significant parts of this, I guess, in my mind, are actually for some of the peripheral figures, which is funny because we've read so much about this sort of drive that the committee had to make this a Donald Trump document that proved somewhat controversial. But coming out of at least the summary and the criminal referrals, like, the thing that this seems really consequential for is like Kenneth Cheesebro, right? This is a guy who folks were like really kind of in the weeds, had heard of, knew about, but I don't think most people thought of as like, oh, this is a central guy on this level of John Eastman. But he's one of the six people who got a referral alongside former President Trump, John Eastman, Jeff Clark, Rudy Giuliani. I mean, that makes him really at the center of a lot of these efforts, at least in the committee's views, and is going to bring him to a lot more scrutiny. And I kind of suspect, I'm heavily dubious that, very dubious that a lot of these sorts of referrals regarding former President Trump are going to make big a difference for a variety of reasons we can get into, at least in part because DOJ is already looking at this stuff and really, you know, a lot of Trump's involvement has already been documented by the committee so centrally. But a lot of these other figures, like it might, DOJ may weigh a little more heavily, maybe a little easier to bring them in investigation, or at least harder for DOJ to not begin to consider them for bringing charges now that they've been elevated and put in this kind of elite circle along with figures like Giuliani. So that's influential. Also, the referrals for ethics for members of Congress, probably not going to go anywhere, but it is kind of a unique singling out of certain people. Some expected Jim Jordan, Kevin McCarthy, others maybe a little less expected. And then, of course, attorneys' ethics referrals, like that also seems fairly threatening along with the obstruction charge. So it's kind of interesting because I kind of suspect its most practical marginal impact on top of the hearings will actually be for those less central figures, even though the narrative of the report certainly seemed to be, and certainly the presentation we saw yesterday, so Trump focused in a way that we know has proven a little bit controversial for folks recently. Does that seem right to you, or am I missing something in all this?
I think one thing to remember as we think about like the role of the report versus other, the like hearings as a body of work, is that the hearings that we saw this committee do were kind of exceptionally produced by the standards of congressional hearings. So I think we have this sense, because we all watched them, that like what people will take away from this investigation was what they saw, what they heard in watching those hearings. I think certainly for like people who watch them, that may well be true. But if we think about, you know, a year from now, 5 years from now, to the extent that like the work of the committee is considered as part of the historical record, like I still think that what the written product says and what it sort of the information that's contained in it is going to be really important going forward. Like, I don't necessarily think that someone who wants to have a sense of what the committee found and what the committee argued 2 years from now is going to like sit down and watch hours and hours of video, which is interesting because like that is where so much of the committee's energy went in doing the investigation. But I do think that like the written product, certainly for posterity, is quite important.
Yeah, just to be clear, I 100% agree for posterity and for historians' sake. And as somebody who actually spends time with long reports, like I appreciate seeing the work. But I'm thinking more in terms of political or policy relevance. It's harder for me to see what the marginal impact is, at least for the main narrative of this, at least in part because even those people who couldn't be bothered to watch parts of the hearing seem much less likely to watch what is going to look like it's going to be a 1,000-page report in the end, or even 150-page executive summary.
So I want to use this back and forth that you and Molly and Scott are having about sort of the things that are not just about Trump, which I think is actually really important. And I agree is in some sense the more important parts of this report, given everything we've already seen in the last year and a half. And another example of this is how the report treats the intelligence failures that led up to the January 6th attack. And in fact, doesn't really call them intelligence failures. You know, Quinta, you, I know, had some very strong feelings. I think you turned into a rage machine, is I think how you described it on Slack while you were reading that part of the report. And there's a great Fruit of Your Rage article on Lawfare about that. But, you know, say more. How did the report, in your view, could have downplayed the intelligence failures? And can you connect that also to some interesting kind of process reporting we've had about some real disagreements within the committee about whether just to highlight Trump, which has been Liz Cheney's goal, versus a more general accounting for all the errors and mistakes that went into January 6th.
Yeah, why talk about intelligence failures when you could talk about intelligence successes, Alan? So to put this in a little bit of context, I think it has been pretty clear since, I would say, the evening of January 6th, the morning of January 7th, 2021, that various law enforcement and intelligence agencies, largely the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, but not exclusively, I'll also point the finger at Capitol Police here, fell down on the job in an astonishing and catastrophic way. in failing to anticipate, prepare for, warn people about what was going to happen on January 6th. The FBI released one intelligence report in advance of the 6th about potential violence. It didn't come from, you know, the desk of the FBI director or anything like that. It came from the Norfolk, Virginia field office. DHS did not release any formal documents about the potential for violence. And this, I think, is you know, a really catastrophic failure that multiple former intelligence officials have described as on par with, if not greater than, the level of the intelligence failures in the lead up to 9/11. So this is serious, serious stuff. There has been, as you said, a lot of reporting about the extent to which staffers, members of the committee were sparring over how much they should focus the report on Trump specifically, and to what extent that would require leaving out these questions about intelligence and law enforcement failures. And Representative Liz Cheney, who's the Republican vice chair of the committee, had been reported to be sort of at the front of the charge in really focusing on Trump personally, which is kind of what the committee did over the summer. It was very focused on Trump as kind of the main villain, and with good reason. So I was prepared to read a summary that was sort of mostly focused on Trump, less focused on FBI, DHS, Capitol Police failures. And, you know, that would be disappointing to me because I care about those things, but I can understand the committee has a really limited time frame. They're working fast. Something, you know, not everything can fit. What I was not expecting was framing that at some points is just sort of overly generous. At other points, I'm comfortable saying affirmatively sort of contorts and distorts and misleads the reader about the extent to which FBI and DHS anticipated and did anything to stop January 6th. If you came away from this, you would, you know, without any background, you might think that these agencies knew what was going to happen. And the report says at one point that, you know, the only thing that they couldn't anticipate, this is a paraphrase, is essentially that, you know, that Trump would get up there and encourage people to march to the Capitol. And that's just not true. So I came away, I mean, reading this with, and you all saw my Slack messages of increasing rage and disbelief as I was reading through this. And, you know, I won't say it's more in sorrow than in anger, because it's definitely in anger, but there's a more than a little bit of disappointment, because I've really been impressed by what the committee has done. I think they've put together an incredible body of work, and it's disappointing, frankly, to see them choose to kind of go out in this way with a document that is extremely misleading about intelligence and law enforcement failures. Maybe the full report will somehow redeem it. I don't really understand how it could, but, you know, just acknowledging that we haven't seen the full document. But I'm pretty stunned, honestly.
Just sort of build on what Quint is saying, it struck me as like an unforced error. So I was, I think, as Quinta was, based on public reporting and what we have sort of watched over the scope of the investigation, I was prepared for this topic of the failures of certainly intelligence sharing and action on that intelligence, if not also intelligence gathering. I was prepared for that just to be largely left out of the report. I was not prepared for the situation to be mischaracterized. There is a footnote in the spirit of reading the footnotes. There's a footnote in the document that says, I'm just going to read it because it is maybe the most shocking piece of writing from this perspective in the document. It says, quote, given the timing of receipt of much of this intelligence immediately in advance of January 6th, it is unclear that any comprehensive intelligence community analytical product could have been reasonably expected, but it is clear that the information itself was communicated. And I think that it's just shocking to read.
Communicated to who?
Exactly. And I think one of the things that kind of troubles me about the way that this information is described in at least the introductory material document that we have is that it feeds into this narrative that we have seen over the past 18 months from congressional Republicans, particularly in the House, that has really sought to highlight the ways in which the Select Committee has not investigated the security failures at the Capitol on January 6th. And that As a result, it will be the new House Republican majority's job to do this when they come into office and have the majority starting in January in the 118th Congress. And I am not optimistic that an inquiry led by the House Republicans on this topic will be in particularly good faith. Like, we've seen lots of instances where folks have tried to argue that this was all Nancy Pelosi's fault. We know that, you know, Kevin McCarthy, we're going to talk about him more later, has already been signaling that, like, this is something that the new majority is going to do. And so I think that the committee, the select committee, did not need to give House Republicans more ammunition to fuel their inquiry into what, again, was a serious failure of preparation of all kinds by the Capitol Police. And that we need a lot of, there's a lot of work to be done to make sure they are better prepared for threats in the future. But it just didn't, like, they didn't need to do that.
I agree with all these sentiments. And it's particularly strange and, well, not strange, but unfortunate in my mind, because this is a sort of endemic problem that's not unfamiliar. I think we've seen from what other national security agencies, which is that executive branch agencies, particularly national security agencies, I think they were just afraid of doing things that were viewed negatively by the president, right? And that's actually a much more systemic problem, kind of with our whole executive branch and the way we structure authority, particularly in the national security and law enforcement spaces, in that we have become so presidentially driven. It's not clear to those agencies how, you know, reinforce what sort of safety nets they have if they were to take action that, you know, the executive were to view negatively. And we saw how the Trump administration treated whistleblowers in the intelligence community in the Ukraine context. Like, this was a moment where Congress actually really could have stood up and installed some mechanisms to give people in the federal government safety nets so they could say things like this that the leadership and the executive branch might not want to hear, and not worry about career repercussions, which frankly is what I think probably was a big dampening factor in why what may have been some raw collection of information at parts of the intelligence community did not turn into warnings, reports, and the things we would expect to happen here. You know, I'm inferring that, but I think it's a pretty solid inference. Congress needs to engage on that sort of stuff. And frankly, to get those agencies to engage in reform of their own, you really need public pressure on them to do so. But, you know, at the same time, we're about to see the House Judiciary Committee potentially break and target the FBI for round investigations, saying that they are politically motivated in the other direction in favor of Democrats. We've already seen Jim Jordan, other Republicans on the Judiciary Committee signal that's going to be a major line of investigation for them. So it maybe teeing it up was going to be a weird moment, was going to add fuel to that fire. That seems like a bad excuse. This is just a systematic problem that Congress is the only one who can address and instead has failed to address, more or less.
Before we leave this topic, I do want to talk about the referrals. And so, you know, a question for Scott and a question for Molly. So question for Scott is, you said earlier that you don't really think that these referrals with respect to Trump, at least, are going to have much impact, you know, on DOJ. And so I'm curious if you think that they're just a waste of time or they might have some other role. And the question for you, Molly, is, you know, in addition to the criminal referrals, there were a couple of referrals to the House Ethics. I don't know if it's a committee or a board or an ego trip, as we discussed earlier, is the right generic measure word for Congress. And so I'm sort of curious what that will mean, especially in a Republican-controlled Congress or House, at least in January. So let me start with you, Scott. Why are you so skeptical that these Trump referrals matter?
Sure. You know, we actually talked about this maybe 6 months ago or maybe even a little further out, I think before the first January 6th committee hearings, when there was that debate where the committee was deciding to pre-decide whether they were going to do any referrals or not as part of their proceedings. And, you know, at the time, my view was, and I think I stand by this, is that maybe there is some logic for committee for doing this if they were worried DOJ wasn't going to act otherwise. And that they might be doing so might provide some political cover or some political pressure to say, look, at least, you know, Congress, a substantial portion of it, and bipartisan, although, you know, by slim margins, thinks there's something here to look at. That's not the state of play now. We know DOJ is pursuing very substantive investigation to this. And on top of that, we know there is a very, very far along investigation in Georgia regarding a slice of the affairs that's happening here, meaning Georgia election interference. And we have the Mar-a-Lago investigation. And frankly, you know, Alan, you correct me if I'm wrong, because you're the former DOJ guy, but all my interactions with DOJ over the course of my career and watching them has always suggested that when they have a set of charges they can bring out of a universe of charges, they go for, particularly for sensitive targets, the lowest hanging fruit. And that doesn't mean they go after every charge they could possibly allocate. And in this case, I think it's a lot more likely DOJ is going to get to a place where they can bring charges they think will stick out of the Mar-a-Lago investigation and potentially out of and we'll see it come out of Fulton County. And that's setting aside the New York investigation regarding Trump Organization, which is a little different, but kind of enters in here. The stuff we've seen about Trump coming out of the hearing, a lot of it I don't think is stuff you could prove in a court of law. A lot of the evidence is pure hearsay. You would have to get some people pretty close to Trump to flip and testify. And even then, it's a little bit of he said, she said. We haven't seen a lot of documentary evidence directly implicating Donald Trump in some of this, the exception being kind of the Georgia call. But that seems to be channeling into the Fulton County investigation. And so because of that, you know, I think I don't really see this really changing the calculus for DOJ very much. They clearly have gotten over whatever political barriers or disincentives they may have had for exploring these seriously, because they very clearly are investigating former President Trump now. And other than that, I'm just not sure these referrals do much. They also just don't seem to track very closely how DOJ has been pursuing this. Like they pursue this very interesting kind of alternative theory about charging for the false elector documentation under a conspiracy to make a false statement charge, but they didn't pursue in a meaningful way 18 U.S.C. 372, which DOJ has actually used to charge January 6 participants in, which I thought was an odd choice. And I'm not 100% sure why. I'm guessing it's because I think conspiracy can carry a larger penalty. I'm not 100% sure about that. But, you know, I just don't think otherwise the persuasive power there really makes a big difference for Trump. The other people, maybe, because, again, it elevates people who are kind of below the radar for a lot of people before, but not for Trump.
Well, speaking of other people, let's talk about the internal referrals. Molly, what about these ethics referrals?
Sure. I will not take very long on this because there's not much to say beyond the fact that like they're also largely symbolic in nature. So it is, I think, notable. There are 5 members of Congress who were subpoenaed by the committee. None of them complied with the subpoena. 4 of them were referred to the House Ethics Committee. The 5th, Representative Mo Brooks is retiring, so will no longer be under the jurisdiction of the House Ethics Committee come January 3rd. The sort of idea here is that, you know, not complying with the subpoena would be a violation of the House rule that requires members to conduct themselves, quote, at all times in a manner that shall reflect credibly on the House. So like that's the logic here. But the most important thing to know is that the House Ethics Committee is evenly divided between Democrats and Republicans. Unlike almost all other congressional committees, it has that balance. So as a result, to take any kind of action, whether it's to initiate an investigative subcommittee, which would look into the allegations that have been transmitted to the House Ethics Committee, whether it is to take any steps beyond that, that requires the vote of at least one Republican. And again, we're going to talk about the nature of the House Republican Conference when we talk about Kevin McCarthy shortly, but I just don't imagine that that there's going to be a lot of appetite among sitting members of the House Republican Conference come January to take up any of this material in the Ethics Committee.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, before we go to the Republican conference, let us take a quick jaunt overseas. So given that it is the end of the year, we thought that we would look back on the Russian invasion of Ukraine and sort of take stock of where we were and where we're headed. So, of course, Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th, 2022. So it's been almost not quite a year of war. Ukraine obviously is doing, I think, far better than anyone expected. It's pretty striking to look back on reporting from those first few weeks where I think a lot of papers in the West and Western officials were really expecting that Ukraine would collapse any day now.
I think we did too, for what it's worth.
Yeah. I was just looking at old New York Times reporting. But yes, I will also take the blame for this. I too was wrong. And also, you know, Russia is doing worse. Not in the sense that, you know, a war is necessarily a zero-sum game, but that the Russian military has turned out to be kind of a shambles. And the New York Times had a really stunning long article about this that I'd highly recommend folks take a look at if they have the time, that's called Putin's War, that goes in depth into just how much of a failure the Russian invasion has been and kind of how we got there. So Scott, let me turn to you first. I'm curious for your thoughts on the article or just sort of overall about the last however many months it's been.
The article is an absolutely phenomenal read with lots of really phenomenal anecdotes and stories, some really, really brutal taken from different aspects of the Russian experience during this war. I actually think the last of the six kind of subsections of the article is the one really worth reading because it frames where I think we are in the conflict now in the Russian perspective, which is that, you know, Vladimir Putin has essentially settled in for the long haul. There's no clear signs that the conflict, as costly as it's been, is going to trigger a sudden drop in his control of the country. He appears to weather the issue so far. Now, we don't know whether that will stay true or not. I mean, Russia is a bit of a black box. Russian politics, particularly when you're talking about among Russian elites that are closest to Putin and are in the best position to oust him if they really wanted to and could get it, feel like they could get enough support to do so, are not people we have good insight into their motives and their relationships and their behavior, right? But until that happens, and we don't really know at what point that will happen, it looks like Putin is still in control of the country and still in a position to continue pursuing this pretty brutal path of war. And then the question becomes, well, can he outlast the West and outlast Ukraine? This becomes a genuine war of attrition in kind of the, you know, classic logical paradigm, right? Which is just saying two parties are waiting out. Neither one knows exactly where their breaking point is. And they're both in a painful situation until one finally caves. That's kind of where we're at right now on the Putin side. On the U.S. side, we've seen pretty notable developments, specifically in the omnibus appropriations legislation that Congress seems poised to move forward with this week before they leave. And that's that we've seen actually Congress really lock itself into a position to provide substantial support to Ukraine at levels above what the Biden administration originally asked. And it's actually positioned itself to do so in kind of an innovative way, passed through a longer window than I thought was on the table, although I may have missed some details on this. What essentially they've done, I think the biggest parts of this that I understand is that they've essentially put in place first an $11 billion kind of replenishment supply fund, which I believe is a few billion higher than what the Biden administration really originally asked for, that basically matches the presidential drawdown authority. That means that the president, as of, I think, May's last Ukraine assistance bill, the president can give up to $11 billion of U.S. military equipment and supplies services to Ukraine as foreign assistance. This allows them to replenish that. So it basically guarantees over the next year or so, the president can fully use that existing authority without significantly undermining, at least permanently, American supplies of equipment. And then it puts in place both a kind of $9 billion, slightly higher than the Biden administration, which I think it asked for around $7 billion, Ukraine Security Assistance Fund in place, and then actually extend this timeline not just to 2023, like a lot of the funds in the bill, but all the way to September 30th, 2024. And then also installs an authority in relation to that fund, which allows the Biden administration to accept contributions from foreign partner nations and essentially recharge into that fund and use it in the same way through 2024. And that basically gives the Biden administration a tool by which it can continue to provide significant financial support to the Ukrainians through almost the next presidential election. That's significant. I suspect it's something that Democrats in the House and Congress got in place because they're worried about pressure from a Republican House. I suspect Republicans in the House and the Senate may have been on board with it as well because Ukraine's politically sensitive for them and it's easier for them to be able to complain and rail and say they would do something to stop the Biden administration without actually doing it. And this kind of frees them up to do that. It's worth noting this is just part of the assistance packages, other things that will need to have appropriated funds for it. But a lot of those are about U.S. activities. This is one of the main channels of foreign assistance. So it's setting the United States up in a better position than I fully expected it to be, although this isn't a huge departure, to actually really provide Ukraine with ongoing assistance, at least for the next, you know, 2 years or so, a little less than 2 years. And that's pretty notable. But again, it's not clear that that's going to be the whole duration of this conflict. We don't know how long it's going to last. And so that war of attrition question is still hanging out there. When do we and when do Russia reach our respective breaking points?
So obviously it's really hard to predict anything in a war. But I do think, Scott, I think you might be being a bit too cautious. I mean, I'll go on a limb and make a prediction that I don't think this is a war of attrition in which each side is waiting for the other side to break. I think Russia has just lost, and that we are watching this play out in slow motion, and maybe not so slow motion, and it may take 3 months, 6 months, it may take a year. But it seems that at this point, honestly, even if Russia does use nuclear weapons, in which case maybe everyone loses, but that there, at this point we can just say Russia has lost and nothing will change that. The Ukrainians will not give up. The United States can supply Ukraine sufficiently for the next 2 years, which is probably much longer than this creaking Russian paper behemoth can last. The Europeans are surprisingly on board. The Chinese, who are spinning into their own zero COVID, actually lots of COVID mess, are probably have no interest in supporting this. And I think it is just a matter of time. Now, you know, how exactly the lines get redrawn, these are all interesting questions, et cetera, et cetera. But I think at this point, it's a little like Germany 1942. Like, they lost the war by that point, and it was just a playing out of the rest of it, right? And that doesn't mean that that's not a, you know, that's some sort of trivial exercise. Lots of more people will die on the Russian side, on the Ukrainian side as well. But in some deep sense, this war does seem over. And I think even more broadly, and maybe this is because I finally decided to read Francis Fukuyama's The End of History and The Last Man, the kind of maybe most misunderstood book of political science and political theory of the last 30 years, and which everyone should read because it's really superb. You know, I think that for understandable reasons over the last, you know, 15 years, ever since the financial crisis and then Brexit and Trump and, you know, all of these crises in liberal democracies, there's been a real question about whether or not these systems can survive relative to, you know, what were thought of as well-functioning authoritarian regimes like China, or at least okay functioning authoritarian regimes like Russia. But I think what you're seeing, and Russia is a prime example of this, but I think you're seeing this also in China, which is why I think these are two actually somewhat related issues, is that closed extractive authoritarian regimes just start making huge mistakes. And the mistakes they make are just tend to be bigger and harder to correct from than the mistakes made by liberal democracies. And I think the Russian example, both in terms of the just unbelievable levels of corruption, mismanagement, and incompetence of the military, which is so vividly illustrated by this article, but then also the more specific, you know, mistake of Putin was in isolation during COVID. And I think, as you said, Quinta, when this all started, seems to have just kind of gotten a bit weird.
Everyone got weird.
We all got weird.
Only but, one know, of us invaded a sovereign.
Yes, exactly. We all got weird, but only one of us has, you know, 10 divisions to play with. He made a mistake and there was no one to challenge him. And so you know, I think we are seeing one of these kind of historical hinge points that comes about every 25 years and that is Russia's defeat in Ukraine. This is my big historical theory for the week.
Yeah, we're going to hold you to that when at our year end in 2023.
We totally should. I would love to revisit this in a year. I'm so curious to see what will happen. I feel like I'm either going to be super right or just unbelievably wrong.
Saying I was drawing too strong a conclusion by going back and saying Francis Fukuyama was right is a bold play.
He was obviously right.
No, I will side with Alan. Fukuyama was right.
I think that totally book is right. Misunderstood. I like parts of
Justice
it too.
For
it's
Francis.
Not a thesis. It's not a thesis. You prove very easily on a podcast, guys. What I will say, I think your parallel to Germany 1942 is key here. And it really emphasizes why this is different and why it will not play out the same way. What did the Allies do after 1942 when Russia was on its back legs, when Germany was on its back legs and losing? They marched to Berlin. It's the one thing that can't be done against Russia. No one can go and dislodge Russia. If they could, if Russia's core, right, could be threatened in that way, it would be much more vulnerable. I think Putin would be much more scared. But they have that nuclear umbrella. That's why it's protective. It's also part of the reason, frankly, I think it's unlikely they will deploy it externally, because it's still there. That's a much more effective deterrent for their internal stability as long as it's still there, right? Once they deploy it, and they break the seal, who knows how things are going to escalate. So it really comes down to much more of an internal calculus on Russia's part. And that's just, we don't know. I agree with you. I mean, I think Russia's obviously lost this war so far. I think Ukrainians have been incredibly resilient. But a big part of winning this war in the future is going to be making sure we manage it in a way that we maintain support of Ukraine's allies, make it as pain, not as painless, you can't make it painless, but make it lower the pain quotient for Ukraine, for Ukraine supporters and others to the extent you can, and just prepare yourself for the long haul. Because I don't think expectations of this conflict is going to be over, despite Russia's numerous setbacks, are well-founded. And if nothing else, out of an abundance of caution, I think you should prepare for the worst.
I take your point about the disanalogy with World War II, and I think it's a fair one. So Len, then let me then say maybe the better analogy is Russia's disastrous invasion of Afghanistan in the 1980s, which again, the United States was never going to march into Moscow to stop, but you know, destroyed the Russian military, destroyed whatever remaining faith there was in the system, and was one of, you know, not the only, but one of the main drivers then of the collapse of the Soviet Union in the late 80s and early 90s. And I think we're looking at something that is, frankly, orders of magnitude, actually, more of a defeat than Russia ever dealt with in Afghanistan. I mean, already, it's more of a defeat.
So I want to make sure that Molly can get a word in edgewise here to talk about the omnibus bill and the funding for Ukraine.
We're talking about Congress twice. This is foreign policy.
And I are such military, renowned military experts. You don't want to just hear us blather for half an hour? Yeah,
Also, it's worth noting that one of the four of us has a PhD in political science and has said nothing about Frank Fukuyama. I will just maybe to wrap up this conversation and go back a little bit to what Scott was talking about before with the current kind of posture of the U.S. government, particularly the U.S. Congress, towards continued support for Ukraine. And then I think this will tee us up nicely to talk about House Republicans more generally, which is that, you know, as Scott said, we did see in this big omnibus spending bill more aid for Ukraine, interestingly structured, as Scott has described, than the Biden administration asked for. And I think this is a reflection that there is concern among at least some folks, probably both in the Biden administration and in Congress, and in both parties in Congress, about the ability of Congress to keep approving legislation that supports the Ukrainians at the level we have been doing since the beginning of the conflict. Particularly because one of the places where kind of the rump faction of the House Republican Conference has been most vocal in their emerging opposition to Kevin McCarthy's bid to become speaker is on this question of like regular order and big spending bills. And this notion that we may well see the biggest governing flashpoints in the next 2 years be around the ability of Congress to approve spending legislation and aid to Ukraine, as well as many other things, could get caught in those bigger fights. And what has sustained the consensus over funding to Ukraine so far is the fact that, you know, particularly in the Senate, we have seen kind of mostly Republican unity on the idea that this is something the U.S. government should be doing. Leader McConnell himself has been part of this. And so the question of whether that unity can be sustained in a world where Republicans control one chamber, and this becomes even more of a thing that Congress is being asked to do because the Biden administration wants to do it, I think is a real challenge. And so that is kind of why I see where at least the congressional piece of this went recently.
I do want to hear Molly's thoughts on Frank Fukuyama, though. I feel like that was teased and I still don't know. I feel like he's out of fashion with the quantitative political scientists. Is that fair? Too much Hegel, maybe?
Yeah, I think that's fair. To be fair, none of my political science training is in international relations. This is shocking to all of you, I know. But I did have to get in, you know, to rep the discipline when you teed up the opportunity to do so.
Well, Molly, you have teed us up very well to transition to our third topic, because we are talking about those very congressional dynamics and where they may lead and what the dynamics may be in the next Congress, particularly in the Republican leadership in the House that you just hinted at in regards in the context of Ukraine. you know, instead of me trying to provide an overview of this, I think I'm just going to hand it over to you to give us a little sense about where things are, because that seems quite redundant of me, a non-expert, while we have you on the line. But we know control of the House obviously is going to go to the Republicans, or at least they have to have the numbers to make it happen. There's this fight with Kevin McCarthy to get the number of votes he needs to actually become speaker. There's holdouts on the far right of his party. Tell us a little bit about the math that McCarthy's working with, the timeline he's working with, because he's only got a little over a week, I guess, to really pull all the pieces in place, where you think it's headed and what the policy ramifications might be.
Right. So the 118th Congress will convene on January 3rd. With 222 Republicans, 212 Democrats. There will be one vacancy. There was a death of a Democratic member from Virginia after the election. And more or less, the first thing that the new Congress does is to have the election of a speaker. And the way that this works is that, so unlike the rest of the party leadership positions in Congress, the vote for speaker is not simply a vote of the members of one's own party. So, you know, when Mitch McConnell stands for election as Republican leader in the Senate, that is a vote of the members of the Senate Republican Conference only. The speaker, because it's a constitutional office, the speaker's election is a vote of the full House. And so working under the, I think, completely fair assumption that no Democrats will vote for Kevin McCarthy, he will have to get enough support to make a numerical majority of those present and voting for a candidate by name to win election as Speaker. The reason I'm attempting to be precise about the nature of the majority is that you know, one option for McCarthy is to get 218 votes from House Republicans to have all 212 Democrats vote for a different candidate, and then lose up to four members of the Republican Conference. What's also an option is for people to either not vote, not show up to the vote, or to vote present, which reduces the denominator out of which this numerator, this numerical majority is calculated. It's all very complicated. In this January of 2019, I did this math live on C-SPAN. It's not an experience I ever want to revisit. But
I think that's a nightmare I've had.
It is. I believe after the 2020 presidential election, the night of Election Day, there was at least one reporter on cable news who was doing like arithmetic on one of the margin in one of the states by hand on air. And I felt deeply sympathetic for this experience. But this is all to say that Kevin McCarthy has very little room to maneuver. And up at least till now, December 20th, there continue to be a sizable number of House Republicans who are skeptical of voting for him. Some of them have said that they will vote for him under there are no circumstances in which they will do anything except vote for someone else. It is also true that when Nancy Pelosi ran for Speaker in 2019, she had people who said they would not vote for her under any circumstances. They would absolutely vote for someone else. Some of those people changed their minds, but the clock is ticking. And as we get closer and closer to the third, it becomes more challenging to see how Kevin McCarthy would win the speakership election on a first ballot. And then that would potentially shift us to the first multi-ballot speaker election that we've seen since, I believe, the early 20th century.
It's time for some game theory.
Again, one of us has ever had to do game theory, and I don't need to do it again.
Lawyers talk podcast. About game theory. We just talk about it in 2x2 grids.
Question. So this is good. This section can be just we ask Molly questions. My understanding is that, you know, one approach that Kevin McCarthy, I kind of call him okay, Kevin. I guess
we should also say that the little pins that said okay, there were periods after the O and the K, which just really added to the air of
Kevin
mediocrity and just a kind of general lack of enthusiasm about the entire thing.
So one possibility, right, is that he's going to pick up his sort of last couple of votes he needs by promising to devolve, which I think is power right to the members, which my understanding is sort of what speakers always do when they need to, you know, get some votes. Are there any limits on the extent to which he can limit his own power as speaker? And if he does end up limiting his own power as speaker and basically creates the ability to call snap no confidence votes, I mean, what does that mean going forward? I mean, you know, is a situation where he could become speaker of the House and then it doesn't actually, like, the House is still totally paralyzed in chaos.
Yeah. So I think that there's a couple sort of moving parts here. So one is that you're absolutely right that one of the things that has happened historically when someone is having trouble getting the support necessary from his or her own party to be elected speaker is they make promises, sometimes to individuals, sometimes to groups of members within the party. So in late 2018, when Pelosi was trying to shore up her support to be elected speaker in 2019, one of the things that she did was promise a set of folks who didn't want to vote for her that she would step down at some point in the future, that she would only serve, I believe it was two more terms as speaker. And so she is ultimately, you know, fulfilled that promise. She also, you know, promised, I believe it was Marsha Fudge, the chairmanship of a resuscitated subcommittee on one of the House committees. So there are things that you can do that aren't exclusively devolving power. In terms of like the mechanisms for the devolution of power, really depends on what you're talking about. Some of them will require votes just in the House Republican Conference because they involve changes under conference rules. Some of them will require votes to change the full rules of the House. That's a usually party line vote that also happens at the beginning of the Congress. So there are a couple different ways that can happen. The thing that you really focus on, Alan, is this question of what's called the motion to vacate the chair, which is the...
It should be something more fun. It should be like the motion to like defenestrate the speaker, like, you know, to press the eject button.
So the motion to vacate is the ability of someone to bring a motion, a privileged motion on the floor of the House that basically would unseat the speaker. We sort of all learned about this most recently in the summer of 2015 when I believe it was Mark Meadows, to return to where we began this conversation, when he was still a member of the House, was leading an effort to try and offer a motion to vacate against then Speaker John Boehner. This is one of the straws that contributed to breaking the camel's back on Boehner's speakership. And he, you know, decided after the Pope came to Washington in the fall of 2015, he was done and he didn't want to be speaker anymore. In 2019, when Democrats took the majority, they made a change to the motion to vacate in the House rules that basically it could only be offered as a privileged motion on the floor if it was done so at the direction of either the entire majority party caucus or the entire minority party caucus. So basically, it would require the support of a majority of either party to offer the motion. And so there's been this question of whether McCarthy would allow that, would sort of endorse a change to go back to the previous, like, anyone can do it model. That, I think, is like the very last arrow in his quiver. I think it is the last thing that he wants to do. We keep talking about it, but he has yet to come out and say that he'd be willing to make that change. And so, in part for the reason that you just described, is that like that would really encourage kind of abject chaos on the House floor if folks were feeling like McCarthy wasn't doing what he wanted them to, what they wanted him to do.
Molly, I want to talk to you about the other kind of like red line that doesn't seem to realistically be on the table here, and talk about why, which is cross-party support, right? Like it strikes me that in a strictly like institutional model, McCarthy would have an incentive to go after some of the more conservative Democrats in the House and try and get them to back him, especially when he needs three or four people. And then he doesn't have to cater to the extreme right wing. And inherently, it would seem that he may want to at least flirt with that possibility so that he has some credible alternative to the most far right wing members of his party who are the holdouts here. Because so long as it seems clear that he can't even get those Democratic votes, they've really got the edge of leverage if he wants to be speaker, right? Because there's just nowhere else for him to go to get those votes. But McCarthy really doesn't seem to be doing this, going this direction at all. Instead, he's really doubling down. You know, we saw this commentary on the omnibus bill, which is ready to pass, that, you know, the Senate Republicans are 100% on board with. And he said, not only would I do I 100% support this little group of right wing House members who say they're going to block the legislative agendas of every Senate Republican that voted for this, that votes for this bill, which appears to be most of them, probably, would seem a little unrealistic. But he says, I would never bring this bill if I were Speaker. Nothing like this will ever get to the floor in the House in the first place. So he's obviously playing to the right. Is there a point at which that even enters into the equation here? Are we just too far gone politically? And what does that do with to Mark Carthy's leverage? Because it just seems like without that alternative, he doesn't really have a choice but to cave to the far right. And if they don't see it as a realistic threat that he ever will go across the aisle or could go across the aisle, then I don't see why they really have much incentive to capitulate until it really looks like, I guess, leadership could completely fall apart on the Republican side. But even then, it seems like they find somebody else. I just don't know what the calculus is when you don't have that option that doesn't seem to be on the table.
Yeah. So I think the number one, the question is like, who would be those Democrats? So we know that, we can sort of bracket for the moment the existence of Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin in the Senate. But beyond the two of them, we really don't have sizable centrist Democratic blocs in either chamber. So it's just not clear who would be the handful of the most moderate Democratic House members who would be sort of willing to go along with Kevin McCarthy as Speaker. In large part, one, because the parties are as polarized as they are, and two, because, you know, the way that McCarthy has played the game so far, as you just described, is to sort of just keep tacking right and making more and more concessions to the right. Also, you know, he himself has, like, the way that he has sort of built his career as the minority leader is by tacking like closer and closer to Trump, becoming sort of like very open embrace of Trump. And so it's not plausible to me that you would get that number of Democrats. The thing that you have seen sort of a couple times in fleeting mentions, and like I think the like only Kevin movement is meant to be part of this, is this idea that like the more I don't want to call them moderate because they're not moderate. I don't want to call them centrist. But sort of the core of the House Republican Conference, the ones who are not the most kind of radical, those folks have not exercised as much of their own leverage as you might expect. They have not, for instance, said, like, we're not going to vote for Kevin McCarthy unless he makes us promises. But I think fundamentally, it is just this question of, like, no Democrats are interested in doing that. They're not interested in saving McCarthy. So, yeah, I mean, we have seen the dynamic that you are describing in some state legislatures. I believe not long ago, something very similar to what you described, like a coalition of some Democrats and some Republicans is governing in the Alaska state legislature. And so it's not impossible. It's just not something we should expect in the U.S. House of Representatives.
Well, folks, we will have to leave the conversation there for now because we are running rapidly out of time. But this would not be Rational Security if we did not leave you with some object lessons to think over in the week to come before you hear our voices once again in your podcatcher. Alan, what do you have for us for an object lesson this week?
So I have an excellent excellent movie recommendation. It's The Courier. It's a 2022 movie. It's a good old classic spy thriller starring Benedict Cumberbatch as Greville Wynne, a kind of very boring, a normal British salesman in the 1960s who is recruited by British intelligence to go and help a high-level Russian defector provide the West with secrets about Soviet nuclear technology, all up in the lead up to the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's actually based on a true story. There really was a Greville Wynne who was the courier with Colonel Oleg Penkovsky, who is still considered sort of the highest placed Soviet intelligence source, and is generally regarded as playing a key role in giving the West kind of ammunition in the Cuban Missile Crisis. It's a great movie, really good acting from both Cumberbatch and the Georgian actor Merab Ninidja, who plays Penkovsky. Just highly, highly recommended. I feel like it kind of flew in under the radar in 2020. It was sort of well reviewed, but I think got a lot of buzz. And so now it's on Amazon Prime. So now we can all watch it.
Well, excellent. We'll have to check that out. Quinto, what do you have for Object Lesson today?
I'm going to recommend my favorite cookie recipe because it is the time of the year when people bake a lot of sugary treats. And so I would like to recommend a recipe from Cooks Illustrated that is for brown sugar cookies with browned butter. It is not entirely foolproof. I have screwed it up. I will say, even when I screwed it up, it was still pretty delicious. Also, when you brown the butter.
Still a bunch of sugar and butter.
Exactly. That's fine. The browning butter smells really good. It makes your kitchen smell, you know, nice and homey. So I recommend these cookies if you are looking for something new to try your hand at.
Well, that's excellent. Although I will warn you, there's a certain point where if you brown butter too far, it begins to smell horrible and it really
tips past. Well, yes, that's what's called burning.
Yeah, it is a really, yeah. When you get that smell in your kitchen, it does not go away for a while.
When the fire alarm goes off, that's a bad sign.
Well, for my object lesson, I'm also sharing a recipe. But first, I'm going to read this review of this recipe that we received from a listener. Scott, I don't use Twitter, but last year I braved its depths to find your apparently criminally underappreciated cocktail eggnog recipe tweet, and I have made it multiple times since to rave reviews each time. The orange zest nutmeg finish is indeed clutch, so if no one else has thanked you for it lately, thank you for putting a good recipe out into the universe. It lives on farther than you know. Thank you, Mike, because that is just the reminder I needed to re-up my eggnog recipe
from last
year.
This is actually a burner account by Scott.
My middle name is Mike. It's fine. Don't worry about it.
Also, did Mike shake your eggnog to space? Like, I don't understand.
I don't know if I get that, but that's okay.
He said it went farther than we know in the universe.
Yeah, I mean, all out there. Yeah, exactly. I get it. I will say I made my first batch. I have been on a bit of a healthy eating kick, so I have not been eating eggnog nearly as much as I did last
Christmas. You're only doing two eggnogs a day for breakfast?
We're doing two eggnogs a night. Yeah, one midday, one at dinner. But so I made some this past weekend for the first time this holiday season. It is really good. So I will re-up that. But I don't want to deprive people of another holiday-themed object lesson. So I will make another cocktail recommendation, and that is the Lion's Tail. If you believe it or not, it is basically a tiki cocktail that has kind of autumn wintertime flavors with allspice dram, bourbon, lime juice, Angostura bitters, and Demerara syrup. It's pretty excellent. If you throw an egg white in there, it makes a really nice flip. So I will put that in the show notes as well.
I'm going to make that tonight, Scott.
It's really, really that good. It's an so excellent good. Cocktail. I like it better without the egg whites because I drink so much eggnog. I kind of blow my egg white quotient on that. But it's really, really excellent. So I recommend checking it out. It's like one of my favorite autumn cocktails. I love it. I love an easy tiki. That's what I'm here for. But before I get too easy tiki this evening, Molly, you need to bring us home with your object lesson. What do you have to share with us?
So if you are unlike Alan and you don't hate sports and you are feeling like...
Don't hate sports. I just leave them. Just...
And you feel like you are missing the World Cup now that it is over. The podcast recommendation that I have for all of you is a podcast that was done by NPR and Fortuoro Studios. It's called The Last Cup or La Ultima Copa. It's by an Argentine journalist named Jasmine Gard. And it is about sort of principally about Lionel Messi's quest, successful, we now know, to lead the Argentinian team to a World Cup victory, but also more generally about sort of the host's experience emigrating from Argentina to the United States, Messi's experience emigrating from Argentina to Europe to play professional soccer. It is about sort of the way that soccer and identity and migration and economics all interact in our contemporary world. And I can't recommend it highly enough. It's just really, it's a really compelling story and it's really well done. So particularly if you are looking for something to fill the World Cup hole in your life, I recommend it to you.
And worth noting, American football is still going on for a couple more months. So hop on the bandwagon, guys. Just kind of squeeze that soccer ball down, make a little oval. It's basically the same game. It's great. Well, folks, with that brings us to the end of this week's episode. Rational Security 2.0 is Like Its Forebear, a production of Lawfare. Follow us on Twitter at RATL Security and be sure to leave a rating or review wherever you might be listening. While you're at it, visit lawfareblog.com for our show page with links to past episodes, for our written work and the written work of other Lawfare contributors, and for information on Lawfare's other phenomenal podcast series. And be sure to sign up to become a material supporter of Lawfare on Patreon for an ad-free version of this podcast and other special benefits. Our audio engineer and producer this week was Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo, and our music, as always, was performed by Sophia Yan. And we are once again edited by the wonderful Jen Patcha Howell. On behalf of my co-host Quentin Allen and our special guest Molly Reynolds, I am Scott R. Anderson, and we will talk to you next week. Until then, goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.